Germany Bells the Cat. The urgent alarm sounded in 1918 by Mr. Hudendijk in his letter to Mr. Balfour, denouncing Bolshevism as a Jewish plan, which if not checked by the combined action of the European powers, would engulf Europe and the world, was no exaggeration. By the end of that year the red flag was being hoisted in most of the great cities of Europe. In Hungary the Jew Bélekun organized and maintained for some time a merciless and bloody tyranny similar to the one in Russia. In Germany, the Jews Liebknecht, Barth, Scheidemann, Rosa Luxemburg, etc., made a desperate bid for power. These and other similar convulsions shook Europe, but each country in its own way just frustrated the onslaughts. In most countries concerned a few voices were raised in an endeavor to expose the true nature of these evils. Only in one, however, did a political leader and group arise, who grasped to the full the significance of these happenings, and perceived behind the mobs of native hooligans the organization and driving power of world Jewry. This leader was Adolf Hitler, and his group the National Socialist Party of Germany. Never before in history had any country not only repulsed organized revolution, but discerned Jewry behind it, and faced up to that fact. We need not wonder that the sewers of Jewish vituperation were flooded over these men and their leader, nor should we make the mistake of supposing that Jewry would stick at any lie to deter honest men everywhere from making a thorough investigation of the facts for themselves. Nevertheless, if any value liberty, and set out to seek truth and defend it, this duty of personal investigation is one which they cannot shirk. To accept unquestioningly the lies and misrepresentations of a Jew-controlled or influenced press, is to spurn truth by sheer idleness, if for no worse reason. To act on such unverified a basis is to sin against the light. In the case of Germany and Hitler, the task of research is not difficult. We have it on many authorities that Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, stated fully and accurately the author's observations and conclusions concerning all these vital matters. Quite false pictures have been propagated deliberately about this book, by quoting passages out of their context, distorting meanings, and downright misrepresentation. Having read many of these unscrupulous diatribes, it was with no little surprise that I read this book for myself not so very long ago. From many conversations I had heard and taken part in, I now realize that most members of the public were as ignorant as I of the real nature of this remarkable book. I propose, therefore, to try and give a true picture of its spirit and purport by quotations from its two main themes. First, the realization and exposure of the Jewish scheme for world Marxism, and secondly, admiration of, and longing for friendship with Great Britain. Writing of the days before 1914, Hitler states, "I still saw Jewry as a religion. Of the existence of deliberate Jewish hostility I had no conception. I gradually realized that the social democratic press was preponderantly controlled by Jews. There was not a single paper with which Jews were connected which could be described as genuinely national. I seized all the social democratic pamphlets I could get hold of, and looked up the names of their authors, nothing but Jews." As he pursued the study of these questions, Hitler began to perceive the main outlines of the truth. "I made also a deep study of the relation between Judaism and Marxism. The Jewish state never had boundaries as far as space was concerned. It was unlimited as regards space, but bound down by its conception of itself as a race. That people, therefore, was always a state within a state. The Jewish doctrine of Marxism rejects the aristocratic principle of nature, denies the value of the individual among men, combats the importance of nationality and race, thereby depriving humanity of the whole meaning of existence. Democracy in the West today is the forerunner of Marxism, which would be inconceivable without democracy. If the Jew, with the help of his Marxian creed, conquers the nations of the world, his crown will be the funeral wreath of the human race," he writes of the days of 1918. "Thus did I now believe that by defending myself against the Jews I am doing the Lord's work." At the end of 1918 there came the revolution and Germany organized behind the unbroken army in the field. Concerning this Hitler wrote, In November, sailors arrived in lorries and called on us all to revolt, a few Jewish youths being the leaders in that struggle for the freedom, beauty and dignity of our national life. Not one of them had ever been to the front. The real organizer of the revolution and its actual wire puller, the International Jew, the revolution was not made by the forces of peace and order, but by those of riot, robbery and plunder. I was beginning to learn afresh, and only now, 1919, came to a right comprehension of the teachings and intentions of the Jew Karl Marx. Only now did I properly understand his capital, and equally also the struggle of social democracy against the economics of the nation, and that its aim is to prepare the ground for the domination of the truly international capital. Sick emperor to offer the hand of friendship to the leaders of Marxism. While they held the imperial hand in theirs, the other hand was already feeling for the dagger. With the Jew there is no bargaining, there is merely the hard, either, or, later on Hitler gives in great detail the outlines of the Jewish disruptive machine. By means of the trades unions which might have been the saving of the nation, the Jew actually destroys the nation's economics, by creating a press which is on the intellectual level of the least educated. The political and labor organization obtains force of compulsion, enabling it to make the lowest strata of the nation ready for the most hazardous enterprises. The Jewish press tears down all which may be regarded as the prop of a nation's independence, civilization and its economic autonomy. It roars especially against characters who refuse to bow the knee to Jewish domination, or whose intellectual capacity appears to the Jew in the light of a menace to himself. The ignorance displayed by the mass, and the lack of instinctive perception of our upper class make the people easy dupes of this campaign of Jewish lies, but the present day is working its own ruin. It introduces universal suffrage, chatters about equal rights, and can give no reason for so thinking. In its eyes, material rewards are the expression of a man's worth, thus shattering the basis for the noblest equality that could possibly exist. It is one of the tasks of our movement to hold out prospects of a time when the individual will be given what he needs in order to live, but also to maintain that principle that man does not live for material enjoyment alone. The political life of today alone has persistently turned its back on this principle of nature, i.e. equality. Human civilization is but the outcome of the creative force of personality in the community as a whole, and especially among its leaders. The principle of the dignity of the majority is beginning to poison all life below it, and in fact to break it up. We now see that Marxism is the enunciated form of the Jewish attempt to abolish the importance of personality in all departments of human life, and to set up the mass of numbers in its place. The principle of decision by majorities has not always governed the human race. On the contrary, it only appears during quite short periods of history, and those are always periods of decadence in nations and states. We must not forget that the international Jew, who continues to dominate over Russia, does not regard Germany as an ally, but as a state destined to undergo a similar fate. On the last page and in almost the last paragraph of Mein Kampf is the following: the party as such stands for positive Christianity, but does not bind itself in the matter of creed to any particular confession. It combats the Jewish materialistic spirit within us and without us. Looking around the world for help in the battle against this terrible menace of Jew-directed Bolshevism, Hitler's mind constantly reverted to Britain and the British Empire. He always longed for their friendship. Always declared Britain to be one of the greatest bulwarks against chaos, and that her interests and those of Germany were complementary and not contrary to one another. He wrote, "It was not a British interest but in the first place a Jewish one to destroy Germany." And again, "Even in England there is a continual struggle going on between the representatives of British state interests and the Jewish world dictatorship. Whilst England is exhausting herself in maintaining her position in the world, the Jew is organizing his measures for its conquest. Thus the Jew today is a rebel in England, and the struggle against the Jewish world menace will be started there also. No sacrifice would have been too great in order to gain England's alliance. It would have meant renunciation of the colonies and importance at sea, and refraining from interference with British industry by competition. In later years, these two themes were ceaselessly expounded. Viz., the Jewish Marxist menace, and the eagerness for friendship with Britain, even down to, and including Dunkirk, Hitler pressed the latter idea on all and sundry, even on his highest generals, to their astonishment. Nor did he stop at words, as will be shown later when, as Liddell Hart informs us, he saved the British Army from annihilation by halting the Panzer Corps, informing his generals the while, that he regarded the British Empire and the Catholic Church as necessary bulwarks of peace and order which must be safeguarded the other side of the hill. Chap. X, by Liddell Hart. Mein Kampf was first published in October 1933. Before it had left the printers, the floodgates of Jewish hatred and lies had been full opened against Hitler and the Third Reich all over the world. English-speaking people everywhere were deluged with fabrications, distortions and atrocity stories, which drowned the voices of the few who understood the real situation. Forgotten in the turmoil was Marx's slogan that before Bolshevism could triumph, the British Empire must be destroyed, and totally suppressed as far as the British people were concerned was Hitler's repeated declaration of his willingness to defend the British Empire if called upon to assist by force of arms if necessary.